Welcome to Senior Living, brought to you by OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During this next half hour, I'm reading articles from AARP, the magazine. And the first one is Inside the Social Security Phone Scam. Here's what I learned by playing along with the bad guys and what you should do if they call. This is by Doug Shadle. Among the hottest scams today is the someone is using your Social Security number ploy. The scam starts with a robocall that usually goes as follows. This call is regarding an enforcement action which has been executed by the U.S. Treasury against your Social Security number. Ignoring this would be an intentional attempt to avoid initial appearances before the magistrate judge for a federal criminal offense. So, before this matter goes to federal court or you get arrested, kindly call us back. I received just such a message recently and decided to call back, posing as a kindly, soft-spoken gentleman with plenty of savings to see how the scam was deployed. This is what I learned from my 46 minutes on the phone. It might help you too. There's an easy way to quickly confirm that you've received a fraud call. Among the first questions I was asked by Officer Alex Morgan was for my name, address, and Social Security number. I gave him fake answers for all three, and yet he claimed he was able to open my file right away. That's a glaring signal to hang up immediately. The goal is to scare you fast. Within minutes of getting on the phone, I had been told that my Social Security number had been used to commit $10 million in fraud and that there were 11 federal counts of fraud charged against me. If convicted, I would face 30 years of prison time. The FBI was hot on my trail and was about to issue a non-bailable warrant for my arrest. Yikes! The callers use questions to further confuse and scare you. After telling me all of the above, Officer Morgan urgently asked, "Do you accept all of these allegations under your name?" What can you say to that? Sudden, absurd questions like these were just additional attempts to get me under the ether, slang for a heightened emotional state in which the victim is no longer thinking rationally, but rather reacting emotionally. They use your fear to get information. Right after asking that fright-inducing question, Officer Morgan next asked, "Please tell me the names of the bank accounts that are owned by you and how much is in each account, so I can determine which are your accounts and which are fake." It was perfectly timed for a moment of vulnerability. Beware the ricochet effect. I told him that I had two bank accounts, again, both fake, that together totaled nearly $100,000. In the con artist world, these amounts made me a whale, someone with enough money to warrant their fullest attention. What happened next was interesting. First, he ratcheted up the fear talk, further detailing the crimes that were committed using my card. But then he suddenly turned kind and friendly. "We believe this might not have been done by you," he assured me. His real goal was to help me clear my good name and capture the bad guy. Going from threatening to being my best pal is also right out of the swindler's playbook to keep me in an emotional state and build trust. Their methods keep evolving. To resolve the situation, I was told someone from Social Security would call me back in a few minutes. He then asked me for a phone number for Social Security. Huh? I've never heard that question get asked before. I looked up the agency's national number, gave it to him, and asked why he needed it, given that he worked there. His response, "Moving forward, I should only accept their calls from that number to make sure I wasn't being contacted by a scammer." When the phone rang a few minutes later, the number that popped up was the one I gave, the agency's national number, meaning the bad guys have technology that let them spoof any number they wanted. That's pretty sophisticated and terrifying. For good targets, they bring in a closer. The person who called me back was clearly one of the top pros in their boiler room. Agent Eric Shaw was more polished, had less of an accent, but was more urgent too. To get my name cleared, he told me I needed a new Social Security number, but first I had to clear out my bank accounts so the bad guys couldn't access them. The secret to their theft? Gift cards. He instructed me to go to my bank immediately, withdraw all the money, then head to a store such as Walmart, Target, CVS, or Walgreens, and buy government-certified bonds. That was his conniving term for simple prepaid debit cards. Finally, the fraud emerges. Once I called back with the serial numbers of the debit cards, the closer told me he could issue a new Social Security number and resolve the situation. That's a lie, of course. With the serial numbers, he had the same access to my money as I would have. He could then steal it all and disappear. At that point, I switched my identity back to Doug Shadel, fraud fighter, had a final back and forth, then hung up. Overall, it was a frightening episode. These guys are professionals working as a team using state-of-the-art technology. But their success hinges on one thing, that you don't know that Social Security or any government agency, for that matter, will never, never, never use the phone to inform you of an issue, let alone a criminal action. And they would never, never, never ask you by phone to withdraw money. We hope you don't experience getting this far into a fraud call, but if you do, just remember that any request that involves your immediate dispatch of money to someone you don't know is a signal to hang up and disregard all that's been said. The next story from AARP, the magazine, is the cover story. Kathy Lee Gifford flips the script. The longtime Today Show host is finally living her dream, singing and making movies, by Judith Newman. Kathy Lee Gifford wants me to feel comfortable, so she pats the seat next to her and scrunches over in the back seat of her town car. She doesn't have to do much scrunching. She is slender, wavy-haired, with an expression that can be best be described as resting perky face. We are just leaving NBC Studios. Gifford, 65, was supposed to have the day off from the Today Show, which she has co-hosted for the past 11 years, but she sneaked back onto the set to surprise her co-host, Hoda Kotb, as part of a segment about the new Fox competition show, The Masked Singer. Gifford dressed up in a lion costume and sang as Kotb and two others tried to guess her identity, a feat they managed quite quickly, though Gifford tried to disguise her voice. Now we are heading to the Greenwich, Connecticut estate she shared with her husband, football legend Frank Gifford, until his death in 2015. Let me say that Kathy Lee is a dream interview because, to put it mildly, she likes to talk. She is the opposite of standoffish, with her sincerity and eagerness and open expressions of faith. This is a woman who time and again has shown a certain kind of fearlessness and authenticity on live television that has captured America's collective heart, first with 15 years on Live with Regis and Kathy Lee, and then in the fourth hour of Today with her peerless wine-drinking partner, Kotb. For all her lack of cool, Gifford is, in a sense, one of the original performance artists, to use a fancy term, drawing on her life as material before it was fashionable. Indeed, she's been willing to say or do most anything without embarrassment and, at the same time, reveal the earth-shatteringly personal, as when she has discussed her husband's 1997 affair. During her hosting days, she also acted occasionally in movies, published 4 New York Times bestsellers, released several albums, and appeared on Broadway. But through it all, there was the talk. Is there anything Gifford won't gab about? Well, yes, Kotb insists. In public, you see only about a tenth of who she is, her close friend says. She gives the illusion that we know everything about her, that she is an open book. She is not. There is a very serious person she keeps inside. And that serious person seems to feel, at a stage in life when many of her contemporaries are winding down, that her most creatively interesting days are still ahead of her, which is why Gifford chose to leave her lucrative Today gig as of April 5th for new challenges. Maybe it's someone else's dream job, she says, but there was a more powerful dream within me that had yet to be fulfilled. All I ever wanted to do from the time I was a little girl was sing and be in movies. When she was in elementary school, she sent Walt Disney a letter asking for a film role. Gifford's bravado may not have paid off that time, but it often does. It's a big part of how she came to write and star in one upcoming movie and direct another. Courage alone doesn't accomplish that, of course, but it can when accompanied by Gifford's brand of smarts, charm, talent, and instinct for what the audience wants. Here's how the new movies came to be, according to Gifford. Craig Ferguson, the comedian and host of the lamented Late Late Show, was guest hosting the Today Show with me in March of 2017. Craig is not a man who holds back. He basically treated 11 a.m. as if he were still on at midnight. So we have to have a 10-second delay, and every day they delayed it a little more. We were like two bad little children. Everyone was terrified. After the run, the two were having lunch, and Ferguson said, "Kathy, if we wait for our agents to get us a job, we'll die waiting. So let's write a movie together." "Okay," Gifford responded. This is the kind of show biz banter that is heard 1,000 times a day and usually forgotten before the soy chai latte is drained. 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I went, dramatic gasp. "I know what the movie should be," Gifford recalls. "I just knew. I got up and started writing, and around noon that day, I called Craig. I said, 'Craig, remember that movie that you and I were going to write? Well, I think I just wrote it. The film, Then Came You, is about a widow who takes her husband's ashes on a trip to the locations of their favorite movies.' Ferguson, as good as his word, signed on to the project, playing a curmudgeonly manager of an estate turned in Scotland. The two meet, and though Gifford doesn't want to give away too much, let's just say what you're going to do in a movie opposite one of the most swoon-worthy Scotsmen this side of Sean Connery? Ferguson likes the way the film came out. It's a pretty good movie, which might confuse people because I'm usually in movies that suck," he jokes. The film is equal parts hysterical, heartbreaking, honest, and hopeful. An announcement of its release date and distributor is imminent, Gifford says. This is a romantic comedy for people who believe that romance has passed them by and they will never find love again, she notes. When I mentioned that I lost my husband, who happened to be a Scotsman 6 months ago, she stops and looks at me for the first time during our drive. It's a club none of us wants to belong to, she says. Hollywood has ignored elderly people, and we're elderly, she continues, as I, at 57, shift uncomfortably in my mom jeans. I'm considered a senior citizen, Gifford says, but I've just decided that at this point in my life, I'm not going to use my senior citizen discount to go to other people's movies. I'm going to make movies for them. Gifford insists that the only thing she has in common with her character in the film, Annabelle, is that they are both widows. When Frank died, their children, Cody, 29, a movie producer, and Cassidy, 25, an actress, were worried about Kathy Lee's being home alone. "That house is loaded with a gazillion memories," she offers, and her voice trembles a little. "Sunset used to be a huge thing in our family. Every day, no matter what, we'd yell, 'Sunset alert!' And we had to stop whatever we were doing, go out and honor another day. And now I still say it out loud to the puppies, Lola, a golden doodle, and Bambino, a teacup multi-poo. We still go and do it, but sunset alerts are some of my saddest moments when it's just me and the dogs at home." After Frank's death, Gifford stopped socializing. "When you're part of a couple, you don't realize that the whole world is just made up of couples," she says. "And all of a sudden, you're that odd number at a dinner party. You're the fifth, seventh, ninth person at the table. They're always making an adjustment for you. I go to professional things alone, but nothing social. I just wasn't comfortable, and I didn't want people giving me that widow look." In the 3.5 years since Frank's death, Gifford has gone on one date, and it didn't go too well, she says. "The man was a very nice gentleman who was just totally wrong for me, and I was totally wrong for him. He didn't share my faith, and I could never spend my life with someone who didn't share my faith." Gifford's father was Jewish, but she was raised in a Christian household and famously became born again at 12. My faith is not what I do for an hour on Sunday mornings. My faith is who I am, she explains. You know, the Bible talks about in Him we live and move and have our being. That means every nanosecond of our life. So what is her solution to the trials of widowhood, at least for now? It's work, friends. And did we mention work? Every year, Gifford goes to Israel, and this year she will be directing a short film there called The God Who Sees, which she describes as a musical journey through the lives of four very different people in the Bible. She's writing songs with country music composer Brett James, who scored Then Came You, and has written number one country hits for Carrie Underwood and Kenny Chesney, among others. But please don't say that Gifford is reinventing herself. That is the worst description of what I'm doing, she says adamantly. I'm not reinventing myself at all. I am evolving as an artist and a human being, and I will be till the day I die. People who think I'm a silly person do not know me at all. I'm 10% silly and 90% dead serious in my life. That certainly squares with Cotby's experience. When she decided on doing Then Came You, she had no backer, Cotby says. She went to start location scouting and casting anyway. Eventually, she did line up several investors. She wills things into existence, Cotby adds. Kathy wants to put beautiful things into the world, which I think is the secret to happiness. Gifford is additionally spending more and more time with newfound friends in Nashville, where she's purchased a small house. The city brings her complete joy. I haven't run into one cynic yet in Nashville. They love God, they love their country, they love music, wine, and food. I'm in heaven there. While Gifford chafes at the notion that anyone would confuse her with her Then Came You character, the two do share a certain outlook. Am I open to new love, she asks. Yes, of course. There's a line in a song I did with Brett called Once Again that goes, you don't find love, love finds you in the midst of a moment right out of the blue. It sneaks up on your heart, hardly making sound, till all of a sudden you find you've been found. It's one of the best lyrics the Lord's ever given me. A lot of people go looking for love, but I think it finds you. When and if it finds me, I will welcome it with open arms. The same goes with this next phase of her career. With her tenure as talk show host, a job that always felt like her plan B, at an end, Gifford is embracing her long-delayed plan A. All I ever wanted to do was be in movies and sing, she says. Now I get to do that. The next article from AARP the magazine is Personal Best, My Sweet Thing. The Stalks of Spring. For chef David Tanis, asparagus is worth the wait. Fresh green asparagus is a luxurious harbinger of spring, most welcome after months of cabbage, squash, and potatoes. By April, in most parts of the country, spring has arrived at last. These days, though, asparagus is available in supermarkets year-round, shipped from Mexico or Peru. Does that matter? If you are a seasonal cook, it does. And I am a seasonal cook. Cooking seasonally means waiting until a particular food is ripe in your region. It's about the joy of anticipation. There's a palpable thrill when spring produce finally comes to market, especially when it's asparagus. But then, I have been called fanatical as far as asparagus is concerned. When I was growing up in the Midwest, asparagus was never on the menu at our house. The only fresh vegetables I can recall were the ones we had in summer. Green beans, tomatoes, corn, and the odd cucumber or radish. The rest of the year we had handy frozen vegetables that went straight from freezer to saucepan. After I left home, one of my first cooking mentors introduced me to the wild asparagus that popped up in the moist soil near an irrigation ditch on a remote California ranch. It was a small patch, but each day we could harvest a dozen spears, which we boiled quickly in salted water, doused with butter, and ate with our fingers. It was insanely good. Such sweetness. That's what I aim for when buying local asparagus. Look for smooth, shiny spears with tightly closed tips. Cook them briefly to keep them bright green and serve them with your choice of sauce. Melted butter, vinaigrette, homemade mayonnaise, or extra virgin olive oil and lemon are good options. Still, asparagus season lasts several weeks, and sometimes plain but perfect doesn't fit the bill. Then it's time to consider roasting or grilling or spaghetti with asparagus, prosciutto, and Parmigiano Reggiano. Assertive seasoning complements asparagus too. This recipe I designed veers Chinese for a quick stir-fry laden with chilies, ginger, garlic, and sesame. Far from overwhelming the asparagus, the spicy contrasting flavors pleasantly accentuate the vegetable sweetness. In the wok, as in life, opposites often attract. And here is his recipe for spicy asparagus stir-fry. It serves four. Ingredients: 1.5 pounds pencil-thin or medium asparagus, 2 tablespoons vegetable oil, salt and pepper, 1 teaspoon grated or minced garlic, 1 teaspoon grated fresh ginger, 1 serrano or jalapeno chili, finely chopped, seeds removed if less heat desired, 2 teaspoons toasted sesame oil, 3 scallions slivered, 1 or 2 red Fresno chilies thinly sliced into rings, 1 teaspoon toasted sesame seeds, and a handful of cilantro sprigs. Here's the directions. Number 1. Snap off tough bottom ends of asparagus and discard. Cut spears into 2-inch pieces. Have thicker pieces lengthwise. Set wok or wide skillet over medium-high heat and add vegetable oil. When oil is hot, add asparagus and toss well to coat. 3. Season well with salt and pepper and stir-fry for 1 minute or so, then add garlic, ginger, and serrano chili. Number 4. Continue stir-frying for another minute until asparagus is cooked but still firm and bright green. Number 5. Transfer cooked asparagus to platter. Next, drizzle with sesame oil. And the last instruction, number 6. Sprinkle with scallions, red Fresno chili rings, and sesame seeds. Garnish with cilantro sprigs and serve. The next article from AARP the magazine, Personal Best, My First Album, World's Oldest Hot New Rocker. Music writer Larry Sloman's long road from adoring fan to recording artist. When I was in second grade in Queens, New York, Elvis Presley was my hero. I bought his albums. I was first in line for his movies. I wanted to be him. My parents would bring the neighbors in, and I'd stand in front of our TV in my underwear, strumming a broomstick and crooning Love Me Tender. Later, at my bar mitzvah, I sang my Haftarah, a selection from the Book of Prophets, doing my best Elvis impersonation. The head of the temple asked me if I wanted to be a cantor. No way. So I put my musical career on indefinite hold. After high school, I went to Queens College, where I was on track for a nice middle-class existence. Then I bought Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan. That single changed my life. Instead of focusing on my studies, I started growing my hair long and going to see revolutionary bands such as The Fugs and The Mothers of Invention. I somehow made it into grad school, where, perhaps aptly, I studied deviance in criminology and volunteered as the music editor of the school newspaper, mainly so I could get free albums. That gig led to becoming a stringer for the Rolling Stone, and before long I was writing a book about Dylan's legendary 1975 Rolling Thunder tour, which also featured Joan Baez, who gave me the nickname Ratso, Joni Mitchell, and Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Traveling with the tour and watching these legends perform nightly was an exhilarating experience, and it moved me to try my hand at songwriting. On the train ride from Toronto to Montreal, I showed Dylan my first attempt at lyrics, a song about a seedy part of Boston. He looked it over as I waited nervously. Then finally he said, "Hey, this is good, man." Coming from your hero, the simplest words of praise can make you feel like you've been nominated for a Nobel Prize. With that validation, I decided to keep at it. Back in New York, I ran into the wife of guitar hero Rick Derringer, and the next thing I knew, I was writing lyrics for Rick. One night at the Lone Star Cafe, I met John Cale, who had co-founded the Velvet Underground, and we began a multi-year collaboration. I provided lyrics for three of his albums. At the time, I was also writing articles and books, but a piece of my heart fell for songwriting. It's one thing to see your books in the window of a bookstore, but it doesn't compare with sitting in the back of a club and watching John Cale sing your lyrics. My career as a part-time lyricist fizzled out, though, when Cale moved to L.A. in 1985. Then, a few years ago, the journalist Mark Jacobson and I started doing a podcast from an East Village bar. One night, Mark had booked two indie rockers, Timothy Bracey and Elizabeth Nelson, to perform on the show. Afterward, they rushed up to me. "Ratso, we loved your Dylan book. Flattery will get you everywhere with me," and the next thing I knew, I was hanging out with them in Brooklyn, soaking up the indie music scene. Of course, I was always the oldest person in the room, but that didn't deter me. I just put on one of my wildest suits, donned my dark glasses, and walked in like I owned every venue. My musical juices started flowing again. I dug up my old books of lyrics and decided that I had to do something to get these songs into the world. My idea was to put out another album of other people singing my songs. I asked a new friend, singer-songwriter Vin Caccioni, if we could record a demo at his home studio in Bushwick so I could use it to persuade someone else to sing the song on my album. I didn't feel any pressure. Hey, this was just a demo, right? Except when we were through recording, Vin threw me a curve. "Why are you going to give these songs to other people?" he asked. "You've got a unique voice." Unique voice. Was that a good thing? I played the track for a successful producer I know, and he gave me the assurance I needed. "What are you waiting for?" Vin and I got to work. Through my journalism and books, I know a lot of heavy hitters, and several were willing to lend me a hand on the project, including Nick Cave, who sang a duet with me. Eventually, Vin and I had an album and then a record contract. Now, we have a band, and we're rehearsing to perform the songs live. I may have taken a 60-something year detour, but I'm finally about to fulfill the dream of that little kid in his underwear strumming a broomstick. This time, though, I'm doing it with my clothes on and in my own unique voice. The next article from AARP the magazine is "Let's Talk, Join AARP in the Fight to Cut Drug Prices." As someone involved in nursing for the past 40 years, I have seen up close the toll on older adults when they can't afford the drugs they need. So I was pleased when the U.S. House Oversight and Reform Committee selected the high cost of prescription drugs as the subject for its first hearing of the new Congress, and I was honored to be invited to testify. As I told the panel of lawmakers, our members consistently tell us they cannot afford the medications they need and are forced to make difficult choices as a result. AARP is a fierce advocate on behalf of older adults struggling to afford the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs. We have heartbreaking stories to tell, compelling statistics to share, and a clear message for Congress and the President. It is long past time to rein in high drug prices. Our Prescription Price Watch report found that the retail price of brand-name drugs increased more than 8% in 2017, four times the rate of inflation. Price increases for these drugs have exceeded the rate of inflation since at least 2006. Virtually all the manufacturers we track raised their prices over the past 12 years. Older adults are especially vulnerable. Medicare Part D enrollees take an average of 4.5 prescriptions a month. We sometimes hear that drug companies must charge high prices to pay for innovation, but innovation doesn't help if drugs aren't affordable. AARP believes that there are common sense solutions to soaring drug prices. Congress should give the Secretary of Health and Human Services the authority to negotiate for lower Part D prices. It should pass the bipartisan CREATES Act to stop drug companies from delaying or blocking access to less expensive generic or biosimilar drugs. And it should cap consumer costs on prescription drug spending. States can also take action to lower prices by, for example, enabling state attorneys general to take legal action against prescription drug price gouging, authorizing states to import safe, lower-priced drugs from other countries, and capping what a consumer pays out of pocket for drugs. Tell our elected leaders it is time to ask. To learn more, go to aarp.org /RX. Thanks for listening to today's Senior Living. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon saying goodbye from Al Radio.